Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Slate Money is sponsored by Dropbox, trusted by people in over 4 million businesses worldwide to keep their files safe, synced, and easy to share with anyone. Try Dropbox for Business free for 14 days at dropbox.com/business. And by QuickBooks. If you work for yourself, try QuickBooks Self-Employed. It helps separate your business and personal expenses, estimate your federal quarterly taxes, and more. See what QuickBooks Self-Employed can do for you with a free 30-day trial at tryselfemployed.com/money.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Making Something New edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as always, by Kathy O'Neill, the blogger from Math Babe.
Hi, Felix.
Hi, Kathy. And because Jordan is on honeymoon, we have reached deep onto the panoply bench.
Very deep.
Very, very deep. To find the one and only Jim Ledbetter, host of, what's your podcast?
Ink Uncensored.
Wow. Because you're allowed to swear.
Yes.
On
the
Panoply podcast.
I've got some good news. You can swear here, too.
Excellent.
Kathy is the queen of the swearing.
Thank you.
She's very good at saying rude things about...
I prefer Empress.
Southampton real estate. So Jim is basically the person who knows everything about everything. So I'm looking forward to this being a Jim Ledbetter monologue while I get to have a little nap.
Thank you, Felix.
In the corner.
We got a cot for you.
He's going to tell us all about the reasons why Verizon seems to think it's a good idea to spend $4.5 billion to buy AOL. Do you remember AOL? We'll talk about AOL. We're also going to talk about the art auctions this week because it's my podcast and I can. But first, Kathy, you have babies on the mind.
I do. I was really struck by an article this week in the Wall Street Journal about IVF, which stands for in vitro fertilization. It turns out there's a big boom in this, and I think it makes a lot of sense. So just to be clear what IVF is, it's when like an egg and a sperm are connected outside people's bodies in a petri dish and then sort of grown for a few days and then implanted in a woman's uterus.
Is this what in the 70s we used to call test tube babies?
Yes. In fact, the first test tube baby was born in 1978. So that was like the first thing. But now it's like, 175,000 this year of these IVF treatments, and that's growing, and it's growing sort of linearly from the beginning, from 1970. It's just incredibly,
Is this because people are having babies later? There's lots of 40-year-old women who find it hard to get pregnant?
Yes. The rate of women having babies in their late 30s has doubled since 1988. But the rate of women in the first half of their 40s having babies has like gone up by a factor of 8. So
I don't know,
which isn't to say it's a lot, but it's just, you know, small numbers get bigger faster.
I don't know that they measure this, but I suspect that the increasing age of fathers also plays a role.
Mm. So one of the things that's interesting, and Felix, you mentioned this when we were talking about this over email, is that the actual price of IVF has actually gone down a little bit.
As measured by the average, I wonder about.
So, what do you think
statistics.
Is going on? And you,
because I mean, on the one hand, it makes sense. It's a relatively new technology. It's becoming a mass technology.
Yeah.
And when you do something more and more, you start getting economies of scale.
Yeah.
It hasn't come down enormously. it's come down a little bit in nominal terms. The numbers which I kind of backed out from the Wall Street Journal article basically said that in real terms, in today's dollars, it's gone down from about $30,000 per treatment in 2000 to about $20,000 today. It's still expensive.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
And that's one throw. I mean, most people are throwing the dice two, three, four, five times. So it really adds up to quite a lot of money.
So what are the what is the actual chances that it actually works on the first time?
This is the amazing thing. So they will give you a set of statistics that relates to your age, your husband's age, et cetera. And the numbers are, you know, depending on your age, somewhere between 20% and 40% that it will be effective on any given throw. So if you're throwing three or four times, you got a pretty good chance. However, the average statistics are sort of meaningless because they're adding in, you know, people from clinics where it's probably not done very well to places like in Manhattan where it's done extremely well and the success rate is off the charts. One of the interesting things about this, and if it's not clear, I did go through this with some years ago.
And you even use the lingo. Like throw.
Yeah, that's a scientific term. The at least in New York State, the statistics are publicly available. You can look at any given doctor at any given clinic, and they have to publish.
And it fascinates me that, like, for all that this is now what I just a minute ago said is a completely sort of mass technology, which people are doing hundreds of thousands of times a year, you're saying that there's actually, this isn't just a sort of plug and play thing, that there are some people who do it really well and some people who do it much less well.
That's right. And the other thing is that the science is growing by leaps and bounds. There's almost some kind of, you know, Moore's law at work. Such that if you read a peer-reviewed scientific paper on IVF technology, by the time you read it, it's out of date. The science is just phenomenal.
So that also maybe explains why the price isn't going down that much, because we're actually being more and more technologically advanced, and sort of, you know, the price of the basic stuff would have come down a lot if it wasn't for the fact that we spent a lot of money on making it better.
Yeah, there's probably a long tail of exactly what the treatments are. But one of the things that just...
Is that a sperm reference?
Well, I'm just saying that probably the vast majority of people go through stuff that we knew about 10 years ago, but then there's a few people who go through special, extra special things.
Right.
One thing that's interesting that I read about was that it's become kind of like a weird financial instrument. Like, you can not only pay for throws, but you can pay for many throws, which what I mean by that is attempts to get pregnant using IVF. But you can even enter into a contract where you pay for a certain amount and it's like they set the price, but you're guaranteed or your money back. So it's actually a pretty complicated financial instrument. But in order to get that price, they actually give you a thorough exam.
Life insurance.
A physical exam, and your husband too. And it, of course, depends on your age, but it depends on all sorts of other things too. So it's kind of this weird thing where you sort of financialized your womb, you know, in all other aspects, physical aspects of your body, which is a weird aspect to it.
There are many weird aspects to it, among which the dramatic inconsistency in insurance coverage for the procedures. So just, for example, when I did this several years ago, I was employed by the Washington Post Company, and our health insurance provider was Aetna, and our policy allowed for a maximum of two procedures that they would pay, I don't know, 95% of it. They basically paid the whole thing. A friend of mine who was at the New York Times, also with Aetna, they paid for zero. Same company, same city, and it just a discrepancy in policy. There's lots of states where it's not guaranteed. I think the journal said there are 15 out of 50 states where they're supposed to cover, you know, insurers are supposed to cover some version of this. There is a different framework in the EU, and this is how crazy it gets. You consider, like, going to Ireland for IVF treatments or whatever, because the National Health Service is more generous, although there's a cutoff point at a certain age. They won't pay for the procedure anymore. Israel has a totally different policy. It's like partly because the technology is new, partly because the demand for it was modest in the beginning. I don't think there is a uniformly acceptable way of paying for this, covering for this, and a kind of consensus from society about whether this is a rational use of healthcare money or not.
Right.
You know, I mean,
or is it healthcare? You see, I kind of look at this a bit weirdly, and I ask myself, compared to the cost of having a baby.
Yeah.
You know, like in general, the cost of bringing up a child, especially if you're doing it in a place like Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking. It's just, it seems to me like this is a bit like daycare, really. It's just
even
something
so,
that is involved in having a baby.
That's a really good point. But let me just also throw in, though, that there's a conflict in some sense. You're basically being pushed to take this treatment as soon as possible because the longer you wait, the harder it is.
Right.
But it also costs substantial amounts of money. So, like, you have this thing, like, wait until you have the money, but don't wait at all.
Well, so you're saying that this has become financialized and there's all these financial products around it. Presumably, those involve good old-fashioned payment plans.
Yes, they do, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. The IVF clinics seem to be paired up with these loan officers, and which is, you know, its own thing. It's pretty crazy.
And are there subprime IVF loans?
I was just thinking of futures market.
Somebody needs to securitize these things. It brings up another a related issue going back to the insurance discussion, which is that not everyone is doing this because they waited too long to have kids or whatever. They're like having trouble conceiving. Some of them are doing it because there's actually like Tay-Sachs carriers in, you know, and so what they do is they fertilize these eggs, and then they check before implanting them whether they're a carrier or that they're going to get sick and die.
So that sounds like a more of a sort of medical. I guess it's a sort of.
But even so, it's not. It's like not required to be covered under Obamacare, which is kind of an interesting and questionable decision. But of course, the other thing, and you're going back to the different nations and their different policies around this, is like, to what extent do we care about our fertility rate as a nation,
right?
I mean, that's what it comes. It's basically a political question.
And I think, and the answer there, especially in Europe, is you care very much. And in places
or
like
should.
Singapore, you care very much. And you're desperate for, you know, the fertility rate to rise. And it's down below replacement rate in a lot of these countries. In the US, by contrast, we have a fertility rate which is significantly above replacement still. And it's maybe less important that, you know, American women have babies.
Yeah, and again, when it comes to sort of, you know, rationing healthcare, the reality is this is a procedure used almost exclusively by the upper middle class and the wealthy. It is not something that I think, you know, people
even in Europe.
No, I'm talking about in the United States.
Right.
And so, you know, there is kind of a question in my mind, you know, should insurance pay for a third procedure, a fourth procedure, a fifth procedure? At what point is it, you know, indulgent or you know,
at what point basically throwing, you know, state subsidized, taxpayer subsidized money at rich people
or private subsidized money? I mean, it's all socialized one way or the other.
To just indulge their desire for the 17th.
Yeah, and there's no, and I'm it's a rhetorical question. There is, I don't have an answer.
Right.
But I do, I could sympathize with someone who would say, you know, the seventh procedure, man, you're on your own.
Right.
Because there have to be better
procedures
ways.
Procedures have to be rationed somehow.
Right.
There's no way you can give everyone everything they want. So before we move on, we're going to move on, Jim, to your amazing analysis.
Presentation.
Of your Jim has brought a PowerPoint presentation on AOL Verizon.
Squint really hard, people.
It has bullet points and everything, so we will get to that. But first, we are going to talk to you about our sponsor. Because yet again, I'm excited about this, we're being sponsored by Dropbox for Business, which is Dropbox. Yay! Jim likes Dropbox.
I enjoy a good Dropbox.
But we all enjoy a good Dropbox. I just start using it sort of almost without thinking about it because otherwise I have no idea which computer I'm going to be on at any given time. And if I put something on one computer and I need to open it on another computer,
cloud.
Email things to yourself.
Yeah.
Who does that anymore?
I totally do. That.
Yeah. Stop it, people. Just use Dropbox. It's much cleaner. Anyway, we all either use Dropbox or feel like we should use Dropbox or know that ultimately it's a really good service. And so the next step is for our employers to encourage us to use Dropbox for everything, professional and work-related. And that's really easy, too, because there's this thing called Dropbox for Business. It gives the employers everything they need to sort of keep an eye on what's going on within the business while being incredibly intuitive to all of the employees because the employees are using it already. My favorite thing is the e-discovery, so that if you get sued, then you can find what people were Dropboxing each other within your company, which I don't know whether why people, you know, think this is a good thing, but this is actually something you need to have in business, so it's a good thing. So go try it out for free. You get 14 days of free Dropbox for Business at dropbox.com/business. Jim, tell us about $4.5 billion,
yeah,
the number of the week.
In cash. I think the AOL-Verizon merger is extremely interesting for two reasons. One, it forces us to think about Verizon in a different way. And two, it forces us to recall that AOL exists, which I think you would be forgiven if you had forgotten that it exists. And when I started to look into it, one of the questions that came to mind is, what is AOL?
Yeah.
What is AOL today?
So what we know about AOL, there, you know, is that there are three, in my mind, there are three things which AOL does. Kathy, what first rings to mind when you think of AOL?
CDs sent to my house, right, in the 80s.
Yeah,
and
so 90s.
Oh, 90s,
so
nice.
It seems to me that there is famously this incredibly lucrative yet mildly evil cash flow at AOL.
Yeah.
Of a bunch of, like, 80-year-old people who might actually be dead at this point.
Approximately 2.2 million people use AOL as an internet service provider.
Who use AOL as an internet service provider. What fascinates me about this is that the overwhelming majority of them have broadband. They don't use it, yeah, for dial-up access.
Right.
But they think that they need to keep on paying because they have an AOL email address.
Yeah.
They do
now,
not.
In some cases, there are places where you can't get broadband, sort of a last mile thing that people still need the AOL dial up. But I think you're right. I think it's mostly legacy and it's shrinking, you know. But how much of the revenue stream is coming from that? $600 million a year. But that's not the largest source of AOL's revenue. Do you know what the largest source of AOL's revenue is?
Can I guess?
Please.
Ad tech?
Yes.
It's all about the ad tech.
It is the largest source of revenue for AOL is third-party advertising. They are essentially helping other publishers fill their ad inventory using mostly, you know, it's programmatic buy, it's banner ads, some search ads,
so
but it's not taking place on AOL properties.
It's not taking place on the Huffington Post. It's not taking place on Engadget.
Those exist too.
But the main thing is selling ads. If I have an ad on Fusion, it might be served up by AOL.
And that's probably, let's call it $1.5, $1.6 billion a year.
This is a tiny fraction of what, you know, Google does with
it's a tiny fraction of what Yahoo does. I mean, it's AOL's really a bit player in this market, which is one of the reasons why I'm having trouble wrapping my head around the more excitable colleagues of ours in the press who are saying, you know, this is a new era for Verizon. It heralds a future of video on your phone and on your mobile device that will be, you know, wonderfully served with ads because we need more ads on the videos that we watch. And I kind of read these, and James Stewart in the New York Times, for example, and I read these pieces and think, maybe? Certainly, they're giving Verizon an expertise it doesn't otherwise possess. I see that. I see the sort of strategic fit. But as you point out,
I don't see that. Okay, because
I want to explain it.
Okay, explain why Verizon wants to sell ads. Why do they want in on that business?
Well, look, this is the way to think about it. AOL has this ad business. It's not a tiny business, but it's a tiny part of the overall market, but it's still a pretty big business. But they can't.
And growing.
It's growing.
20% a year.
And it's invisible to people, which is why we don't know about AOL. But the point is that they'd like to sell their ads for a lot more money.
Right.
Right now they're selling kind of shitty ads for shitty months.
Yeah, I assume programmatic buys are somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 per thousand.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is that if you can target effectively, then programmatic ad buys can actually bring in more money than old-fashioned, you know, selling ad buys, depending on how narrowly you can target the audience. And the idea, which I've been trying to get my brain around for most of this week, has been this idea that Verizon has, depending on who you ask, somewhere between 75 and 100 million customers in the U.S. and has a lot of information about those customers. And it can therefore somehow combine that information with the AOL technology to be able to target ads at very specific Verizon users.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Thank you for articulating it. The point is that Verizon has all this data about their users that they don't know what to do with. They basically have been pairing up with advertisers to try to monetize it. But what they really like to do is find an advertiser with a larger reach, and AOL is that. So they're complementing each other. Verizon has data that almost nobody else has, which is like very, very good mobile information, which Google and Facebook all want. And they try to get it. Facebook, for example, tries to get it by making people get a Facebook app and log in. And then while they're logged in, they can steal all the information from the person who's using that app. But Verizon gets to have all that information for anyone who's ever using their phone. And the question is whether they can link it up with your online browser. And then once they can, they have all this information about what you do online on your computer and your phone.
And so the idea is that if I'm just using an app or surfing a website on my Verizon phone, then the app or the website that I'm using, there will be some really smart back-end technology and will say, ah, I see it's a Verizon phone. So rather than serving up some generic ad that everyone else is using this website, we're going to target to you, the very specific Verizon user, a very specific ad which people will pay lots of money for.
Way more money, like on the order of 100 times more money, depending on what kind of ad it is.
So two thoughts. One is that the best ad-serving technology in the world on a mobile device is still something that I think – 99.8% of people are going to ignore. I suspect that the only people who actually click on ads are children using iPads. And the second thing is, it's not clear why, in order to get that kind of technology, I can see its use value. Why you need to own the company? Why these things aren't available, as it were, as a service? Why can't they just license
probably
AOL's technology?
Because Verizon has $4.5 billion lying around, and it doesn't see anything better to do with the money.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they bought it, nor do I understand why $4.4 billion was the right price. But I do want to make the point that what they're thinking was, they know that you just walked by, Eddie Bauer, and you went inside because GPS, because Verizon knows exactly where you are.
Is there an Eddie Bauer to go into?
I don't know. I'm just saying they know where you are.
Yeah.
Then they don't have to target you on your phone. They can target you on your browser. That's the point. AOL targets you on your browser.
What
so when
world,
you get back to your computer, they're like, hey, you just went to, we just noticed you went to Eddie Bauer.
Yeah.
Here's a coupon for Eddie Bauer. So it's not that, I agree that mobile advertising is a long shot, but we know about internet advertising.
I actually disagree with that. I'm looking at this new thing which came out this week called Facebook Instant, which is a very immersive kind of way of telling stories within an app. I'm looking at Snapchat Discover, which is also a great way of telling stories within an app. It's actually surprisingly similar to Facebook Instant. Facebook Instant more or less stole a lot of stuff from Snapchat there. And I'm seeing people spend, huge amounts of time just drinking in various different types of content on their phone. I'm not at all, I agree with Jim that people don't click on ads. They don't click on ads on desktop computers. They don't click on ads on phones. Or if they do, it's just because their thumbs are too fat. But they do love to just drink in great stuff within Facebook, within Snapchat. And if you can create lovely sort of branded messaging campaigns.
Sure.
It'll work.
You just used a very interesting word for the first time in this discussion, and that is content. And it's striking to me that the content part of AOL, which by the way exists, is almost never mentioned by anyone talking about this.
Except for in the context of who is going to buy Huffington
right.
Post now what, that well, it's clearly
how,
owned.
How quickly are they going to get rid
clearly
of
clearly owned
content.
By someone who has no interest in owning Huffington Post.
Yeah. So I kind of agree with you, but then that also suggests that Verizon, in order to make this work, is going to need some kind of content play, right? I mean, the Facebook deal depends largely on the fact that they're working with partners who are producing stuff that people want to read. Ads for ads' sake assume that there is something, and of course, on I guess with television, which is the thing that people are pushing, you know, there will be. But I don't know. I
have this vision. I have a vision, and I don't know if it's possible. But I have this vision that when I'm in Snapchat Discover, and there are, you know, unbelievably large millions of people who spend unbelievably long amounts of time in Snapchat Discover, that, you know, when I'm swiping right to read the next story in Snapchat Discover, whether it's the Daily Mail or whether it's, you know, Huffington Post or whoever.
It's not just dick pics anymore, people.
Or whether it's... No, wait, hang on. I mean, let's be honest about this. This is Snapchat Discover. We're not even talking about people messaging here. We're talking about big publishers publishing really immersive long-form content using a great app. This is, you know, let's not even be, like, snarky about Snapchat. It's an incredibly powerful
medium. I
didn't
even know about it.
And, you know, you have people like Vice and everyone publishing really long, immersive things. And you swipe right and you see the next one. You swipe right and you see the next one. And some of those can be ads. And some of those can be really immersive ads. And they
sure.
can have video and they can have, you know, all manner of stuff. And if the ad tech can tell the, you know, app that I'm on a Verizon phone and this is who I am, and I'm going to be particularly interested in a story about, you know, Subarus because I'm interested in buying Subarus or something like that, then Subaru will pay a lot of money to be able to serve that ad up to me on my phone. And I see that as the future of, you know, mobile advertising.
I can see that. But again, you're talking about a place that is already a destination for people, right? The Verizon AOL deal, for the most part, is just about pipes. There's nothing in the pipe.
Correct.
And so,
because the ad tech doesn't care whether I'm in the New York Times bit of Snapchat Discover or whether I'm in the Daily Mail bit. It will serve me up the same ad regardless.
Yeah. But I do, you know, I do see it as a sign that Verizon wants to sort of expand the type of company that it is. I mean, Stewart puts it in the context of the thin bundling that they're doing with their cable offerings, right? Which is a truly revolutionary thing to suddenly say to customers, you don't have to buy all 180 channels that come with our package. You can tailor it to your needs. You can drop. You can add. You can do this sort of thing. And I guess that wanting to get more active about the video space in mobile is a next step for them. But in terms of, just to Kathy's point about the knowledge that they have of their customers, the customer satisfaction with companies like Verizon is notoriously low. And the idea that that they know how to take advantage of that data is, I think, still largely theoretical.
And this is a common theme, I think, which we have on this podcast, is that for all of the sort of dystopian and even possibly utopian promise of big data,
yeah.
the fact is that most people faced with this enormous amount of data just have no idea what to do
right.
with it.
Right. And I will say that you know, looking at a couple of pioneers in the digital video space, thinking of Netscape and Amazon, one thing that those two companies have in common is they built a superior user experience. People love Netscape. People love the recommendation engine. People love Amazon. They love its, you know, easy returns. They love its wide selection. Its incredible reliability. The layout of the Amazon website is sort of famously efficient, and that kind of relationship to customers and audience desires, I think, is very successful. What Verizon has done to date, what AOL has done to date, I think, is not based on.
But can't they piggyback, Jim? Can't they say, listen, you know, Snapchat has worked it out, has managed to create that incredible connection with the audience, and we're just going to serve up ads within Snapchat using our ad tech. Why do they need to get the audience loyalty? Why can't they just allow Snapchat to have the audience loyalty?
But then what's the role of AOL?
they have the ad tech, which will serve the, you know, the right ad to the people who are using Snapchat.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't think AOL has ever been known for optimizing the user experience, right? So they should stick to invisible pipes.
I think in, you know, in the 90s, the content that was created by or often curated by AOL did a pretty good job of serving its audience need. It was kind of walled garden within the internet before, especially before.
Yeah, if you wanted dick pics in the old days, you needed
right.
to go to an AOL
chat room.
I knew it would come back to that.
AOL was a pioneer in instant messaging. I think that's worth mentioning. Some by their own technology, some by acquisition. So I do think that historically the company has had a good relationship with its customers, but that's ancient history.
Yeah.
You know, that's just not what this company is about anymore.
So we are going to move on to art in a second. But before that, we have another sponsor. This is a good day for sponsors because this one is QuickBooks Self-Employed. For all of you self-employed people out there, which is a growing proportion of you, and it's many of the Sleep Money listeners, this is just a really handy way which helps you separate out your business and your personal expenses. You can track what you spent for work, what you spent on yourself. It, you know, the thing about being self-employed, and I know this from personal experience, is that you have to write these checks every quarter, and you hate writing large checks, which you can't afford to write every quarter only to get a refund at the end of the year. That's painful and you don't like that. QuickBooks Self-Employed can
write the check for you.
Write the check for you. Send it off by e-check writing technology and make sure that you're not spending more than you need to. So, free 30-day trial. Try selfemployed.com/money. That's You don't even need the QuickBooks in there. It's just tryselfemployed.com/money. It's good for you. All right, art.
Felix, what happened this week in the art world?
So this week is one of the two big auction weeks. In fact, this is pretty much the biggest auction week because, you know, it's combined with the Frieze Art Fair. Everyone who's anyone in the art world descends on New York this week and one of the central things which happens in New York this week is big art auctions, and no art auction in the history of art auctions has been bigger than the art auctions we've seen this week. And specifically, there's this one auction which happened earlier on in the week called Looking Forward to the Past, which is kind of interesting because historically what's happened is that the auctions have come in two flavors. There was the Impressionist and modern auction, and then there was the post-war and contemporary auction. So Impressionist and modern would be everyone from like the late 19th century through to 1940-ish, and then post-war and contemporary would be everything, you know, from 1945 onwards. And Christie's is completely dominating the auction market. It's not even really a fight anymore between Christie's and Sotheby's. It's all about Christie's these days. Christie's did something very interesting. They had their Impressionist and Modern auction. There was a $50 million Mondrian in there. It was, you know, a big deal. They had their post-war and contemporary auction, which was even bigger and made $659 million with, you know, Warhols and Rothkos and Twombleys and that kind of thing. But then they also had this thing called the Looking Forward to the Past auction, where they mashed up both together, and they just found a whole bunch of really big name art from relatively old stuff, like the Picasso, which you probably heard of, which sold for $179 million, to relatively new stuff like a Peter Doig canoe painting, which sold for $26 million, which is also crazy, and they mashed it all up, and that one made over $700 million in one evening sale. Overall, Christie's made, you know, if you add in the Sotheby's stuff, the Phillips stuff, we're talking about $3 billion of art being sold just at auction, just in one week. That doesn't even include probably another billion at the art fairs and that kind of stuff.
Okay, I have a ridiculous question.
Yeah,
can I ask my stupid question first? Because I I don't understand art at all. So I only think of these things as objects that people for some reason buy and for some reason value. And we could go into like, what does it mean to have value? But even stupider, I would like to know how often a given piece of art gets sold. Because I feel like one way you could get these crazy auctions is if you just, hey, every time an auction comes around, you sell all the Van Goghs. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's a finite number of Van Goghs. It seems like there's always one being sold. Like, what's the churn on these art?
There really aren't. I mean, Van Gogh is an interesting example.
Yeah.
Because he basically never comes up for auction. I mean, there was a flurry of them coming up in the late 80s. There was a little sort of art market bubble in Impressionists in the late 80s. And you may recall the Portrait of Dr. Gachet, which held the all-time auction record up until this week, which was sold in 1990 or 1991 for what in today's money is about $150 million.
I guess my larger question is like,
there were sunflowers and irises. There were lots of very expensive Van Goghs back then in the late 80s. But then what happens is that they all wind up in museums, basically. The way the art world works is that collectors collect art and museums collect collectors. So you once you get a big collection together, generally what happens is that big collection winds up getting donated to some museum or other. And then once it's in a museum, the museum doesn't what's known as deaccession very much. And so one of the reasons why post-war and contemporary art is increasingly hot these days is because basically that's all of the only good art which is still on the market and still available. No one's going to go out and sell a Vermeer.
Okay, so you're saying that it's like only certain non-museum pieces are even sellable.
Right. And museums very rarely sell that.
I guess my question is why now? Like when do these collectors decide to sell to bigger collectors or is it just because they think it now's a good time to get a good price? I mean, is there a bubble mentality going on?
The owner of the Picasso bought it at auction, actually. It was bought at auction for $32 million in 1997.
Okay.
So that's, a nice, 10% a year compound annual growth rate right there. It's rumored to be a Saudi collector in London who, basically what's happening is that Christie's is going around the world, going to every single major art collector in the world and basically buying up their work. What's happening in these auctions, and one of the reasons why no one knows whether Christie's is even making money in these multi-billion dollar auctions, is that Christie's is guaranteeing a huge, most of the big lots. They're saying, we will guarantee you a certain amount of money for this painting, no matter what it actually sells for in the sale room. So the seller loses a lot of the uncertainty that there used to be around selling at auction. And Christie's is taking a lot of the financial risk itself.
So they're really good at it. But does that mean that they're like ruining their own business in the future because they're like, accelerating the natural life of this painting that it's going to end up in a museum sooner?
I mean, I don't know. Is there any reason to believe that the new buyer of the Picasso is more likely to donate it to a museum than the old owner of the Picasso? These things, change hands in the private market until they don't.
Yeah.
I want to get back to this question of the channels through which these auctions take place. You said that historically it was done in these two kind of separate eras.
With World War II in the middle.
And that somehow by combining them, they created a synergy that wasn't there before. I'm fascinated by this.
So a lot of the new collectors really just deal in contemporary art, post-war contemporary art, and what Christie's decided was that if they could mix it up a bit, they might be able to get some of these newer collectors interested in people like Picasso. It's not like Picasso is unattractive to people who normally buy Peter Doig. It's that they just never really appear in the same place. And Christie's has been interesting at like creating these kind of high-profile theme sales rather than just doing it chronologically, saying, we're going to throw a bunch of interesting art together and see what happens. And it seems to be working
and
quite well.
Are the buyers that distinct? So if you go to one auction traditionally, you're not the same guy who goes to the other auction?
Well, certainly, the buyers of Old Masters are not going to be the same as the buyers of Dan Colin.
Until now, it sounds like.
And now, there's still distinct collectors in different eras. I can see, for instance, the idea that Peter Doig and Picasso might be bought by the same person. But it's true that art is driven by connoisseurship, and there's a limit to how much you can know about.
Right, right.
So if you know about one bit of the art world, that's the bit that you collect.
Right. Is my impression is that the market is highly cyclical. Is that is there academic research on this, of how the market tracks the overall economy?
Well, I mean, so the last big bubble, as I said, was the Impressionists in the late 80s and early 90s. And then it kind of went away, and now we have this big bubble in contemporary art. Is it fair to say that there was like this economic boom back then and then nothing happened and now there's an economic boom now? I don't know. I mean, there's a very broad sense in which the art market tracks inequality. Because what we're talking about here is, you know, $100 million paintings. And frankly, you need to have an insane amount of money to even sure. think about being able to sure. afford a $100 million painting. So, you know, the more inequality you have, the more people can play at those levels.
And I heard that one of the things that's actually kind of different and not cyclical maybe is the international nature of the buyers. Is that something that you've heard about? Like that?
So this is, we've been hearing this for a few years. It was the Russians for a long time, and now everyone's talking about the Chinese as like the new big buyers in the market. And it's all based on sort of rumor and hype. There's certainly big Russian collectors, there's certainly big Chinese collectors, although, again, just anecdotally, the Chinese collectors have been pulling back a bit with this crackdown on corruption in mainland China. So it's hard to tell. The fact is that the old-school U.S. and European billionaires are still the heart of the market. They might not be the marginal price setter every single time, but they are the people really providing, you know, the cash. You have... They even make a market. There's this fantastic quote from Steve Wynn, the, you know, very American casino magnate, who bid on Picasso. And he said, you know, he'd bid at $125 million. And he said, $125 million is where I would buy it. $179 million is where I would sell it. He like has a bid offer spread on this.
Yeah,
thing.
It seems, going back to your inequality comment, it seems like there's this phrase floating around. I don't know if you've seen it on Twitter, vanity capital.
No.
That this is, the idea is that there's a huge, because of sort of increased inequality, there's like this huge amount of money just going towards status symbol, period. And the art market seems to be like the quintessential version of the vanity capital.
And some of it is. And then one of the interesting things is that, you know, there was this post-war Italian formalist called Anselmo, who did a series of five or six pieces where he just took an iron bar and wrapped a piece of fabric around the middle of the iron bar and twisted it until it was very twisty, and then hangs it on the wall where it's sort of twisted up, and then it's called torsione, it's called torsion. And that one of those just sold for $6.4 million. You know, it looks like an iron bar hanging on the wall. So, you know, it's an important work of art. It's actually a really good work of art. And it's not clear that that kind of thing is vanity. Maybe it is to an extent. And certainly, you know, the big Rothkos and Freuds and Bacons and that kind of thing are, you know, instantly recognizable.
Cut rate vanity, sort of a bargain basement vanity.
But there's a lot of buyers, and there's a lot of buyers with money, and there's a lot of buyers with highly educated art consultants saying this is really important, you need it. And just the amount of money, you know, as I say, like $26 million for Peter Doig, $37 million for Basquiat, $43 million for Twombly, $30 million for Christopher Wool. And these aren't all-time masterpieces. These are just good examples of these people's work. And you're like, wow. Okay. Let's do the numbers. Jim, you know about this, right?
I do.
You do.
I come with a number.
You've come with a number.
Good job.
My number is 91 million. And that is the dollar amount of Avon stock that traded on Thursday.
I love this
good story.
Such a weird story. You know, look, markets are subject to rumors all the time. And this week there was a rumor that
it wasn't
Avon,
a rumor; it was an SEC.
I'm getting to that. There was a rumor that Avon was going to sell itself, and the market did what the markets usually do in those situations: is bid the stock up. It turns out there was an SEC filing from a company called PTG Capital Partners Limited. And so everybody...
Not to be confused with TPG.
Which had bid on them, I think, in 2010. Or Avon sold its stake in Avon Japan to that firm in 2010. And so this made the market go crazy for a while, for about 20 minutes. And the stock went way up. And then Avon said, "But we have received no such offer." And then it seems that this firm actually doesn't even exist. And so someone has walked off with a pile of money made in a really short period of time. It's the kind of thing that I think, you know, the SEC will get all over. Will they catch the right people? I have no way of knowing.
But the SEC can trace relatively easily who sold the Avon stock in
Absolutely.
That 20-minute period, and they can just like start looking to see how many
also,
of those connected to PTG.
Presumably, someone has to sign the document that was filed. You know, I mean, I think there is a trail
can
there.
Can I just say, though, that I think it was pretty sneaky because, as I understand it, the actual document had lots of misspellings.
Yes, that's right.
So anybody who wanted to hide their tracks would be just like, I sold it because I knew it was a fraud. It was obvious. I'm just saying, like, the SEC has some real work to do because it is kind of obviously a fraud.
Yeah, and let this be a lesson to you, Slate Money listeners. If you hold individual stocks, then this is how you have to, what you have to do to make money is be watching the stock all day, every day, and then seeing it spike on some stupid press release, and then read the press release and realize that it's complete bullshit, and then sell the stock within that 20-minute period while it's still trading at an elevated level. It seems
like more than most people will do.
More than most people are capable of.
You should just buy a Picasso.
You should just buy a Picasso. Well, okay, so here's my number. My number is $1 billion.
Can you say it like this?
$1 billion. I will put my pinky in my mouth and say $1 billion, which is even more than the price of a Picasso. $1 billion is the amount of the box office gross of Avengers Age of Ultron. The
really?
Amount that it has taken in just in cinemas just in the past 2 weeks.
Holy moly. Whoa. Really? $1 billion?
$1 billion.
Wow. I missed that.
It's no one even likes this movie. this is just, you know, the, you know, May blockbuster comic book thing. It's the sequel to the last Avengers movie, which itself was a sequel to a whole bunch of Iron Man movies. And it's just the latest in the series. And then, you know, comic book nerds are all going to go and see it because they have to. And it's better than, you know, the Thor movie. And it's not as good as, you know, the other. It's just a pretty middle of the road comic book movie,
yeah.
But it's
$1 billion.
The truth is, I almost saw it. You know, and I don't even see movies, but
no.
Because I have teenage boys and I have a 6-year-old boy, and they're all kind of like, hey, maybe we're obligated to see this movie too. And then I'd be like, maybe I'm obligated to see this movie. And we escaped, but I'm just saying, I can see it. They've done an amazing job at making like an entire population feel obligated to see a movie.
And it just, I mean, to realize, just to underscore here, we're talking 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's brought in $1 billion. By the time all is said and done, and they've got the video on demand, and they've got the action figures and stuff, this one movie is going
to
be...
I know it's important to adjust these things for inflation, but I assume that at $1 billion in 2 weeks, it is the box office record holder.
No, I don't even think it is. And this is actually global. So the U.S. part of that is about a third.
Ah, okay.
But it's still over
it's still
350
a lot of money,
million or so in the U.S.
What was
about
Avatar
600 million in
2 weeks?
I don't know.
It's all about Avatar.
So, but that's the amount of money that is in franchises. We don't care about, you know, narrative anymore. It's just get the big name characters up on the screen and make your money. I'm going to go see Mad Max instead.
And I'm looking forward to the next Star Wars movie. My number is 76%. It's 10. Do you know that of the people teaching, instructing at higher education places like colleges and universities in this country, 76% are non-tenure track.
Mm.
And more than 50% are actually part-time. part-time instruction at a college or university is hard work.
Yeah. Does that include community colleges?
Yeah. All higher education. But it's just, it's reached that.
Says Kathy O'Neill, the former part-time instructor at Columbia University.
No, I've never been a part-time instructor. And I'm telling you, like, part-time instructors teach more than tenured professors. And they get paid a lot less. And they have no security. It's a rough business. And it's growing. I mean, obviously, I'm telling you 76%. I don't know what it was 10 years ago, but it was a lot less than 76%.
On which mildly depressing note, well, you know, it's yeah. So what are you saying? That higher education is the new nail salon?
Well, I mean, I'm actually not the biggest proponent of tenure, but I'm just saying, like, it's correlated with terrible working conditions. And no, not nail salon level working conditions. These people are typically they either have green cards or passports, so they're still doing okay.
So in any case, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for listening to Slate Money. Subscribe to the show by searching for Slate Money in iTunes. Write to us at slatemoney@slate.com. Give a big clappy thank you to Audrey Quinn, who once again has turned a mildly chaotic recording session into something amazing. And to also to Joel Meyer, the managing producer, to Andy Bowers, the executive producer, and especially to Jim Ledbetter.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jim.
Who's going to plug his podcast one more time.
Listen to Ink Uncensored, the best show on the Panoply Network, among many, many good shows. You can look at all of them at itunes.com/panoply.
And of course, we will link to Ink Uncensored from Slate Money. And maybe one day, Jim will return the favor and link to Slate Money from Ink.
Absolutely.